From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, FSN talks to the family spokesman of an American teenager allegedly beaten by Israeli police in Jerusalem.
He hasn't even been charged with a crime, and here he is the victim of police brutality, in-house arrest, and the officers who beat him still free to go, which makes absolutely no sense, especially for a country that claims it's a democracy.
Also today, a major review will delve into allegations that leading British politicians were at the centre of a paedophile ring in the 1980s. And fresh allegations of the US spying on Germany adds further friction on ties between the two allies.
The relationship that the United States has with Germany is incredibly important. This is a very close partnership that we have on a range of security issues, including some intelligence issues.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The White House says it wants to work with Germany to resolve the case of a German intelligence service employee accused of spying for the United States. The report has raised concerns about a further major deterioration in bilateral ties, as FSN's Washington correspondent Daniel Renches reports.
Last week, a 31-year-old employee of the German Federal Intelligence Service was arrested and accused of stealing over 200 documents. White House spokesman Josh Earnest wouldn't comment on the case, but accentuated the positive.
That partnership is built on respect, and it's built on decades of cooperation and shared values. All of those things are high priorities, not just to this administration, but to this country.
Leaked documents from former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden last year included the revelation that the US was collecting data on millions of German citizens and that the US had monitored the cell phone of German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Hamas is vowing retribution after a series of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. The militant Palestinian organization says five of its supporters were killed in the strikes, but the Israelis say the men died after handling explosives. The head of Britain's National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children is to lead a review into historic allegations of child abuse by British politicians and public officials. From FSN's London Bureau, Dan Whitehead reports.
The British Home Secretary Theresa May has told MPs an investigation has been launched into allegations of organised child abuse at Westminster back in the 1980s. Updating the House of Commons, Theresa May said the prosecution of the people behind these disgusting crimes is a priority. The allegations centre around reports there was a cover-up at Westminster surrounding a dossier containing information on those involved in a paedophile ring.
Edward Shevardnadze, the former Soviet foreign minister who was one of the architects of change in the USSR, has died at the age of 86. He went on to become the first president of the newly independent nation of Georgia. From FSN's Europe desk in Brussels, Jack Parrock reports.
From a committed communist Soviet politician, Eduard Shevardnadze became the first head of state of the newly independent Republic of Georgia in 1992. Despite quelling a civil war in the country, he was overthrown from his position in the Rose Revolution of 2003 after allegations of corruptions and irregularities in parliamentary polls. Georgia is still in a precarious position politically, with many accusing the Russian Federation of causing unrest in the breakaway regions of Transnistria and South Ossetia.
As the World Cup continues in Brazil, soccer fans are mourning the loss of one of the game's greatest players of all time. Alfredo Di Stefano was a legend at Real Madrid in Spain. He was 88 and suffered a heart attack. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A man accused of obstructing the investigation into the Boston Marathon bombing has gone on trial. He's one of three university friends charged with offences committed during the intense manhunt for the two brothers accused of carrying out the bomb attacks. FSN's Malcolm Brown reports.
Azamat Tajayakov is one of two students from Kazakhstan facing federal charges of obstructing justice and conspiracy in the aftermath of the deadly bombings. Prosecutors say they removed items, including a laptop and fireworks, from the dorm room of their friend, accused bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev, while he was on the run. The 20-year-old Kazakh students could face up to 20 years in prison if convicted. A third student, an American citizen, is accused of lying to federal investigators.
British Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne and Foreign Secretary William Hague are in India at the start of a two-day trip to meet recently elected Prime Minister Narendra Modi and discuss investment opportunities. From FSN's London Bureau, Jake Rashbass reports.
Since Narendra Modi was elected Prime Minister in May, several countries, including Russia and China, have sent senior ministers to visit India, and Britain is now following suit. Mr. Osborne and Mr. Hague are seeking opportunities for British firms to invest in India's infrastructure and defence sectors, but are also hoping to secure investment by Indian companies in the UK. This comes after reluctance in recent years by foreign investors to invest in India as a result of bureaucracy and corruption. Indians hope that Modi's election will lead to reforms and ease foreign investment, which will hopefully lead to expanded growth. Jake Rashbass, London.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can interact with us at Feature Story. And that is... There's more from us on Twitter, so interact with us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. An American teenager, allegedly beaten by Israeli police in Jerusalem, has been placed under house arrest for 9 days. Footage, thought to be of Florida resident Tariq Abu Qadir, shows two Israeli border police holding down and repeatedly punching the masked teen before taking him away. He's not yet been formally charged with any crime. 15-year-old Qadir was detained after his cousin's funeral. Qadir's cousin was allegedly abducted and burned alive by Jewish extremists. It's believed the 17-year-old's death was retaliation for last month's murders of three kidnapped Israeli teens. FSN's Steve Mort spoke to Hassan Shibli, spokesman for the Qadir family.
Unfortunately, he's still right now under house arrest, which is outrageous because he hasn't even been charged with a crime. And here he is, the victim of police brutality, in house arrest, and the officers who beat him still free to go, which makes absolutely no sense, especially for a country that claims it's a democracy. So we're just trying to get Tariq back home to the States as soon as possible so he can get the proper medical treatment that he needs.
I mean, is the family surprised that they've become the focus of such an important issue in the Middle East?
Well, what's amazing is that, look, Palestinian youth face this kind of brutality quite often, from what we've heard from the family. And in fact, Tariq's cousins are still languishing in an Israeli prison, some as young as 13 years old, with broken bones, broken hands, broken feet, and they're not released because they're not American citizens. And I think the family's been extremely grateful that because of the international media coverage of this issue, and because Tariq was an American, he was able to get out so quickly. Otherwise, the concern was if he was just another Palestinian kid who doesn't have an American citizenship, who wasn't born and raised in America, he could still be in the prison. Which is, it's great news that he's out, but it's very sad that it's because of that, you know, color of his passport that he gets to have a better life than other human beings.
Well, Israel says Tariq was taking part in violence himself before the beating occurred.
Look, he's a great kid. He goes to high school here locally. He's just your average American kid. He's not, you know, he wasn't engaged in any illegal activity. But that being said, I mean, what he was doing is irrelevant. I cannot imagine any sort of justification for why police officers can take a child, handcuff him, and then proceed to brutally beat him. I mean, the video speaks for itself, stomping him on the face. I mean, they used deadly force against him. I don't know how Israel can dare justify any disgusting actions. And I think they've already been on the record saying what happened is illegal, but we need to see them put that into action by punishing those officers involved and revise its policies so no more children are hurt in that manner. Tariq was actually arrested and beaten on his own family property. You know, he had every right to be there. The Israeli police officers did not. And there's no way you can justify harming any child of any race, any religion in the manner that those officers did. And what we really need right now is for both sides to just stop the violence against each other, because just too many children, innocent children, Israeli kids, Palestinian kids, Muslims, Jews, people of all different faiths and ethnicities are being hurt. And we really need to value human life equally, regardless of the race or religion.
Presumably you would condemn the killing of the three Jewish teenagers too.
Absolutely. I mean, we were utterly appalled when we heard about the Jewish kids that were abducted and then unfortunately murdered. I mean, it was a very tragic criminal act that we condemn to the strongest terms. Look, for us, human blood is human blood. Children are children. It doesn't matter what race or religion there is. And this idea of retaliating against one another is unacceptable. 2 weeks before those three Israeli teenagers were brutally killed, you know, two Palestinian kids were brutally killed. And how far back are we going to take the violence? It doesn't matter who started what. What matters is what we do today. And what we need to do today is ensure that both sides stop the violent acts, especially against the innocent children.
Is the family satisfied with the response from Washington to what happened to Tariq?
You know, unfortunately, the U.S. wasn't doing much until the worldwide attention, until we issued the press release and people started wondering why this young American kid from Tampa was brutally beat by police officers in Israel. Then the State Department got involved. At that point, within 24 hours of that release, the State Department did go ahead and meet with Tariq. But even the U.S. counselor was unfortunately shown no respect by the Israelis. He and the family were made to wait for 3 hours before they could see Tariq. And even then, the family was not allowed to see Tariq. We certainly appreciate the state statement by the State Department that those actions were unacceptable and not justifiable. That being said, we do want to see the U.S. government holding the Israeli government much more accountable, especially in light of the billions of dollars that taxpayers send to Israel. I think it's just a slap in the face of the American taxpayers that, look, we're going to take all your money and we're going to treat your citizens with such brutality and impunity.
So what are the plans now? When does Tariq plan to return to the U.S. and does he ever hope to go back to Jerusalem?
That was one of the concerns of Tariq's father. He said, look, I want to make sure Tariq is able to return here and visit his family and visit his friends, you know, just like any other child should be able to. Their plan, however, right now is to return to the U.S. as soon as they can, as soon as Israel will allow them, really, to especially get medical treatment for Tariq. I mean, we've had several experts review the footage of the beating that he received, and they said, look, this kind of trauma to the head could cause hundreds of thousands of dollars in need for treatment and severe brain injury that may not be detectable now, but could be foreseeable in the near future. So we need to get him the proper medical treatment here and home in the U.S. as soon as possible.
Is there a Palestinian-American community here in Tampa? And if so, how are they viewing this?
Right. There's a very large Palestinian-American community in Tampa. And actually, in Florida, we have about 50,000 Florida Muslims. And this really brought together the whole American Muslim community here in Florida. And they've had protests, not just in Florida, but in Maryland and California. And it didn't just strengthen the American Muslim community relations, but believe it or not, it even strengthened Jewish-Muslim relations as Jewish leaders and Muslim leaders stood up together and said, look, we need to stop this cycle of violence.
FSN Steve Mort speaking to Hassan Shibli, spokesman for the Qadir family. This is FSN Reports.
The relationship that the United States has with Germany is incredibly important. This is a very close partnership that we have on a range of security issues, including some intelligence issues. That partnership is built on respect, and it's built on decades of cooperation and shared values. All of those things are high priorities, not just to this administration, but to this country. So we're going to work with the Germans to resolve this situation appropriately.
Josh Earnest with the White House response to allegations the US has been spying on Germany. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says if reports of a suspected German double agent selling secrets to the US are true, it would be a clear contradiction of the trusting cooperation between the two nations. The suspect is thought to have handed over more than 200 documents over a two-year period in exchange for some $34,000. US spying on Germany has caused friction between the two allies since it was revealed that the US has been monitoring Angela Merkel's cell phone. Our Berlin correspondent Iris Spitzer joined us earlier.
There has been a strong reaction here in Germany, both from the media as well as from German politicians. People were, of course, extremely upset at the previous revelations that the U.S. Had been tapping Chancellor Merkel's cell phone. That came from the Edward Snowden NSA leaks. So to now have another spying scandal involving the U.S., people were very much up in arms. We saw both the German foreign minister as well as the minister of the interior demanding some sort of explanation or even just a statement from the United States. We haven't heard anything from the U.S. at this time yet. The German media also sort of calling for Germany to sort of reevaluate its relationship with the United States. Now, of course, a lot of that, it's hard to say how serious these sorts of things may be, but certainly just in terms of perception of the U.S. and the perception that they may be taking advantage of Germany in some way or just not sort of having the respect for Germany as an ally, an important ally, it's pretty upsetting to a lot of people here.
And Ira, do we have an idea, an understanding of how this latest allegation could influence ties between Germany and the United States, already strained?
Yes, whether it will actually affect the German-American relationship, that's kind of an open question. You know, we've seen some strong reactions from some members of the German cabinet. Chancellor Angela Merkel making sort of a, not really any sort of accusatory statement on her, during her trip to China, but just saying that it was a serious case if these revelations do indeed prove to be true. The United States and Germany are extremely important allies in terms of being trade partners, also, you know, with some of these situations going on in the world, such as in Ukraine, you know, they do work pretty closely together. So will this damage the relationship? I mean, it definitely doesn't seem, it seems like it has the potential to do that. It's hard to say how common this sort of thing might be. You know, in this case, the person was caught, and obviously the media, just the fact that it's a double agent situation, it's, you know, it's a very, it's a story that people are definitely talking a lot about here. But whether it will have any real impact on any sort of policy decisions or the relationship between the two countries, we'll certainly have to wait and see, for one, what actually happened, if we ever do find out anything close to the full story here, and two, perhaps how senior of, on the U.S. side, sort of how senior of a level this might go up. That will be another question that will be hopefully be answered here in the coming weeks and months.
Ira Spitzer in the German capital. Now, allegations that leading British politicians and public figures were at the centre of a paedophile ring in the 1980s will be looked into with a major review set up by the current government. Conservative Home Secretary Theresa May has appointed the head of a children's charity to examine her department's handling of historic allegations of child abuse. Prime Minister David Cameron says he will leave no stone unturned in looking into allegations of historic abuse and how public bodies dealt with them. FSN's UK correspondent Ollie Barrett joined me from London.
Well, Theresa May, who is the Home Secretary, has appointed the chief executive of the child protection charity, the NSPCC, to lead a review into her department's handling of historic allegations of child abuse. And that is expected to report back to her within 8 to 10 weeks. And it will also look at how police and prosecutors dealt with any information that they were handed. She's also setting up an independent inquiry under an expert panel, and this will look into the handling of child abuse and allegations of child abuse by public bodies. And that could be upgraded to a full public inquiry if that expert panel decides that that is necessary, decides that that is a good idea. And the Home Secretary says that these reviews must be wide-ranging if they are to be credible.
I want that to look widely at the question of the protection of children, and I want it to make sure that we can be confident that we will not see people in the future looking back today and saying, if only they had done this measure or that measure. We must ensure that the lessons that have come out of the various reviews that are taking place are indeed not just properly learned, but are acted upon.
And Ollie, why are these allegations that date back to the 1980s surfacing now?
Well, partly because a Labour MP called Simon Danchuk has been campaigning on this issue for some time. And last week he called on the former Home Secretary, Lord Britton, Leon Britton, to say what he knew about a dossier of paedophile allegations that was passed to him back in the 1980s when he was the Home Secretary of the UK. Those files were given to him by a late MP, and that MP's son says that the allegations were explosive and that they were about very powerful figures in British life. We've also had another Labour MP called Tom Watson making allegations of a link between abuse and Parliament and Number 10, he says. Because of that, the Home Office carried out a review of hundreds of thousands of files to try and identify information about organised child abuse. That covered the years 1979 to 1999 and found 527 potentially relevant files that the department had kept, but perhaps more importantly, 114 files that were either missing, destroyed, or not found. And that has, of course, led to claims of a cover-up at the Home Office.
And Ollie, this comes amid a series of other high-profile investigations into paedophiles in the UK.
Yeah, the Metropolitan Police are running what they call Operation Fernbridge, which is looking into allegations of child sex abuse in the 1970s and 1980s at a guest house in the southwest of London. which was also the scene of alleged parties involving MPs and other members of the British establishment. We have police up in Manchester investigating allegations of abuse by a late MP called Cyril Smith and about a potential cover-up by authorities in Rochdale. We have a number of NHS hospitals publishing reports on allegations involving the late BBC presenter and DJ Jimmy Savile. Other hospitals due to report on that in the autumn. We have Operation Yew Tree, which has been set up following the death of Jimmy Savile in 2011, and the many, many allegations about him and alleged sex crimes and paedophilia. All these investigations going on in parallel, really, and that is why now Theresa May, the Home Secretary, is trying to bring some of it together in an overarching series of reviews and perhaps public inquiries.
Ollie Barrett in London. US financial laws designed to stop illicit money transfers may end up empowering criminals and extremists in Somalia. That's the conclusion reached by some Somali Americans seeking to send money back legitimately to their families through traditional services called hawalas. The remittances are often a lifeline for Somalis who use the transferred cash to buy essentials like food and medicine. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
A handful of Somali Americans have in recent years been recruited and trained by the radical Somali Islamic group Al-Shabaab. That's led to concerns from banks here that they risk breaking US laws designed to prevent illicit money transfers to extremists and criminals. Somali-American Gulad Kasim is a consultant for humanitarian organizations and businesses.
I would say the vast majority of families, including mine, that are in Somalia, in country, and actually also in Kenya as well, rely on these monies that are being sent over. It is essentially a lifeline, because you have to remember there is no government, so there is no essential services. And so that's the primary need, is that it's a lifeline.
To receive money from the US, they rely on a traditional and informal service called a hawala. But US and other international banks are denying hawala's services to wire money internationally. The banks are required by US law to know who is originally sending the money. Gulad Kasim says that unless there are changes, the system will increasingly rely on whoever's willing to physically bring in large foreign cash supplies.
So it's going to be, you know, the whatever is efficient and whatever is available. So that's where, you know, you could have bad actors come in and really either play a monopolistic role or be, you know, sort of be empowered that now they have the control of the flow of the money, literally. So it's very important to maintain this ability to send the electronic transfer of money.
A recent report estimated that remittances total $1.3 billion each year, much higher than the total of humanitarian aid flowing in. The US Treasury says it's encouraging the hawalas here to stay in compliance with US laws and that there remain legitimate ways for Somalis to transfer money. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. The late Eduard Shevardnadze resigning from his role as Soviet foreign minister in 1990. A year later would see the collapse of the Soviet Union. Georgia's first president passed away at the age of 86. He held the position of foreign minister in the Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev and was heralded for his part in the arms negotiations between the USSR and the West, which are said to have greatly reduced the risk of nuclear war. On news of his death, Mr. Gorbachev described his former Soviet colleague as a bright character with truly Georgian temper. I asked FSN's Simon Marks how Eduard Shevardnadze will be remembered.
There are really three different ways in which he's going to be remembered. First of all, there's the way in which the world will remember him. This is the man who, in December 1984, took what was, we now know, a most prophetic walk on the beach with Mikhail Gorbachev in the then Soviet Republic of Georgia. They were attending a Communist Party meeting. They were both shocked at what they were hearing from the ancient old men who were running things back in Moscow. They decided decided to sound one another out about the direction of the country. And really, it was that walk on the beach that sowed the seeds for the era of reform, the glasnost, the openness, the perestroika, the restructuring that Mikhail Gorbachev as Soviet leader and Edward Shevardnadze as Soviet foreign minister would then seek to introduce. So he'll be remembered by the West as a seismic historic figure. He'll be remembered in the former Soviet Union as one of the architects of the Soviet Union's destruction. As you know, Mikhail Gorbachev's own approval ratings are very much in the tank in Russia and in other parts of the Soviet Union, a very controversial figure. So too Edward Shevardnadze. And in his own country, and it became a country, Georgia, he went on to become the first president of newly independent Georgia. Even as he was lauded in the West for being a reformer, he was accused as the Communist Party chief in Georgia of having, at best, turned a blind eye to some fairly overbearing policies towards those people who disagreed with him, and at worst, of being an architect of hardline policies at home in Georgia. He then became controversial in the 1990s as its first post-Soviet elected president. So a very mixed bag in terms of the way he's going to be remembered.
And Simon, during your time as a correspondent in Russia, to use some press jargon, you actually doorstepped Edward Shevardnadze.
Well, it was fascinating. It was December 1990, and there was a meeting of the Soviet Parliament taking place in Moscow, and Shevardnadze suddenly strode to the podium and shocked all of us who were journalists in Moscow at the time by announcing his sudden resignation and warning darkly that dictatorial forces were operating behind the scenes that were going to derail the process of reform that he and Gorbachev had introduced. And we all sat around wondering what he was talking about. Was he referring to the fact that Gorbachev himself had in recent months become more conservative and drifted away from the path to reform? Or was he warning, and we now know that he was, about the dark forces that were conspiring to overthrow Gorbachev and within 6 months would indeed briefly have overthrown him in the coup that took place in August 1991? So we were sitting around in the office debating what he meant, and I, a relatively new arrival in Moscow, said, well, you know, if this was a British politician who'd resigned like this, we'd go and stand outside his house the following morning. And everybody said, oh, can't be done, impossible to do it here, they'll move you on, not a chance. And I said, well, I've got nothing to lose, let's go and give it a try. So we got up at 4 o'clock the following morning and found out where he lived. He lived in this apartment building right next to the foreign ministry, and we stood outside it. And some security guys came over and said, what are you doing here? And we said, we'd like to wait for Mr. Shevardnadze to leave home and head to work. And they made phone calls, clearly calling his apartment, clearly were not instructed to move us on. And sure enough, at around 7:30 in the morning, on a bitterly cold December morning, he comes down and he walks out of the building and he sees us there. He's obviously been tipped off to the fact that we're there. And he comes over and talks to us perfectly openly about why he'd decided to make this speech, what he meant by it, what his own personal plans for the future were. And it was really redolent of the fact that this was a man who, even though he was operating at the upper echelons of the Soviet greasy pole, had been sufficiently exposed to international politics and international media that he, much more than many of the people around him, knew how the game should and could be played, and he was a willing participant in it.
FSN's Simon Marks. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, we turn our focus to Turkey to better understand the future direction the country will take. That's Tuesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Simon Marks on the bulletin desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.